If you could just say something.
1, 2, 3, 4.
That's great. We've got the level right. Yeah. So let me just say that this is Alistair Greenhill talking to Barry Bushell at his home in Burwell on the 14th of October 2013. So Barry, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself and perhaps telling us where and when you were born.
As Alistair said, I'm Barry Bushell. I was born in a small village in North Norfolk. My people were agricultural contractors, engineers, and they also did a bit of farming. I'll be 80 in January, and goodness knows where the time's gone. I had such a fortunate upbringing as a small boy. I spent time on the farm, in Dad's workshop, and also helped out with some of the machinery. The highlight, and I can remember this before the war, one of the highlights was when harvest came round. Harvest was much different then than it is today. For a start, before you cut the field, people went round with a scythe and cut corn down so that the binders could get round without wasting any corn. And one thing that sticks out in my mind is the smell. Weeds weren't killed off. And I can still remember that as a kid, you'd get wild mint and all sorts of bits and pieces. Then the next thing was the rabbits, because rabbits were considered a very valuable food source in those days. When you got older, you helped, or I thought I was helping, I suppose for the early years I'd get in the way. When you'd cut the corn, it was into what Norfolk expression we called shoofs. And then you stack them up. And I'm desperately trying to remember what we called when I think they call them stooks round our way. They'd stand for several days, maybe. Yeah, I'll go back there, because we call what we call shocking. You'd stand the shoes up in heaps. And it could be quite painful, because as there wasn't the weed control, you'd have thistles, and the thistles could scratch your arms. The next thing you did was you had to cart them. And most people were using horses. And that is the second job I can remember doing. I was what they call holdsy boy. You'd go up between the shocks. That's the word I was looking for. You'd go between the shocks. And two men would be pitching the sheaves onto the shoofs. Here we go. Onto the wagon, and they would obviously load the wagon. You'd take it, some people would make the stacks on the field where the corn was, but we used what we called a stack yard. And the wagon used to go back the stack yard to the stack. Now, this was the first job I ever had that I can remember. We had a horse-driven elevator. It consisted of a horse works where you had a big crown wheel, and the horse was coupled up to this, and it walked round and round and round, and the pinion drove the crown wheel that drove the elevator onto the stack. Now, my first job, they put me in the middle where the horse was and gave me a stick and told all accounts I must keep the horse moving. I think they actually paid me So maybe that's the first paid job I ever had. It was, as I say, such a wonderful childhood, and I'm sure that the older people in Burwell can associate with this. Dad was a thrashing contractor, and I used to go out...
Sorry, Dinder, what age were you when you were
I'd be about 4 years old, when I was looking after horse works. Yeah, 4, probably.
All right. As long as that.
Yeah, I had my first gun when I was 10, shotgun. But that's the way it was, isn't it?
Yeah, you were going on to talk about your father.
Yeah, Dad, who was... my grandfather and my dad and his brother were, as I say, contractors, mostly thrashing, but we also did binding, cutting corn. This is for other farmers, ploughing. In fact, the tractor that's up in the museum is a 1020 International. It's all posh with rubber tyres now, but that was the first tractor I ever drove. Or not that particular one, but one like it was a 1020 International. Dad had several tractors and 5 traction engines for the thrashing. And my people go back, I know, to 1740. In fact, my great-great-grandfather and my great-grandfather were responsible for inventing the thrashing drum as we know it today, and that those same principles are used in a combine. So, and I used to go out with one of the men, or even Dad would take a turn out. And I remember as a, well, maybe 8, I'd be 8 or 9 by this time, or 7 or 8, and the war had just started, well, it was underway, and we'd go out in the very early mornings to a farm where this particular thrashing set was. And the farmer wanted you to start work at dead on 7 o'clock. So that meant you had to be there pretty early to really stoke the fire up and get steam up. And you also used to get on the stack that was thatched and take the thatch off. Well, I used to help to do this, and the rats used to be running over your shoes, so there were quite a lot of rats about in those days. In fact, the most rats I ever known to be killed were 443 in Holcombe Park. That's what we call a 2-year-old wheat stack. And there was no end of thistles in this, and they didn't bother the first year to thrash it out, so they left it for another year. But this time the rats had a heyday, and the funny thing was there was also weasels in there. Now rats and weasels don't mix, but on this particular one they did. Anyway, as a boy, I'd go and help. It wasn't a tender age of 8, but when I got older I used to, what we'd do, chaff and colder. Let's bag the chaff up. You know, when you thrash corn, you have the good corn, and there's another shoot that took the tail corn. Now, the tail corn is not such good corn, and that'd be fed to chickens. And you also had the chaff, and the colder was really the dust and muck that came out. Now, you really had to work hard when you were thrashing wheat, because the wheat floits, as we used to call them, that they really, it was really, you had to run to keep up. Now, barley, with the barley harns, you had not so much work to do, but you itched like the devil, because the barley harns would, oh, goodness me. And we didn't have posh bathrooms when we got home in those days. That was a zinc bath outside in the kitchen. But anyway, but previous to all this, the world so changed for us people in villages. So many people were using horses, and really things hadn't changed that much for quite a long while. But they decided to build an aerodrome in Little Snoring, which Morris that joined Great Snorri. Like the Burwell people, you had one at Bolsham, you had one at Newmarket, and you had one at Snailwell. So that must have been quite a disruption or a change of life. There we were used to, well, traction engines were pretty up to mark, but these people turned up with these massive bulldozers, and I can remember the numbers, but as a little boy, I didn't know what they meant. They talked about TD-18s and Cat this, and it wasn't until later years that I realised that they were the names of the International and the Caterpillar bulldozers. Now, this brought great excitement to us kids. We didn't realise the tragic business that was going on. In fact, I remember we had Lancasters there for a time, which I later worked on, actually. I worked on Lancasters when I was in the Air Force. But these were almost unique, because most Lancasters, if you talk about Lancasters, people will talk, oh, Merlin engines, yeah. They did have Merlins, most of them. But the particular squadron that we had a snoring had Hercules, which were Bristol sleeve valve radial. And I think I'm right in saying that we were about the only country in the world, I think the Germans tried, the Americans tried to build successful sleeve valves, but I believe that we were the only people that successfully built a sleeve valve radial. In later years, when I was working at Marshall's, we had an ambassador aircraft that BEA used, and they were Centaurus. And they were a sleeve valve radio, and they reckon they got the most powerful fuel consumption power ratio of any radio. This is what I was led to believe. Well, we better get back to snoring.
Yeah, I was going to say how there was all this new technology. How did that affect the threshing and the milling?
Well, the drums and that, they continued on after the war, and then the combines came. You know, a dad, he bought what I believe to be the first pusher combine. That was a Minneapolis Moline. The early combines were pulled by crawler tractors. They're almost like a big binder. I remember Brandel Farms, the first one I ever saw. It was during the war. I came from America. It was a fantastic size, really, for the tyres, about 16 foot. I mean, the first combines that I knew of were about 8 foot, but 12 foot. But now they're absolute monsters, you know. In fact, I stand and marvel. Nowadays, I take my dogs out The other year, last year it was, I watched this monster of a machine taking up sugar beet. And it took three tractors and trailers just to keep up with her. Yet when I was a youngster, we used to have two horses. I don't know whether two or one. Yeah, I think it was two horses that pull a sugar beet plough and take one row out at a time. And then the man had to go along and knock the things together to knock the muck off. And then go along and cut the top off. And it's so labour-intensive. And they usually, in Norfolk, where there's heavier land than here, used to use horses and tumbles, because by this time the ground was wet. Mm-hmm. And the tractor would get stuck, it was too heavy. So they used horses to pull a tumble, and then you'd got to throw it on the tumble, and then they'd take it to somewhere where you formed a heap of sugar beet. And our sugar beet used to be picked up by a Mr. Mortar. Now, Mr. Mortar had an arm blown off, or at least his hand blown off, in the 1418 war. And he had a hook for one hand. But he used to load the sugar beet on a fork. And a sugar beet fork was about six tines, I think, with knobs on the end so it didn't stick into the beet. And he used to throw these things up. And Dad would say to us boys, because I had a brother, Michael, help Mr. Mortar to load the sugar beet. And of course, that used to go to Candley factory. So I don't know how many miles Candley was, quite a distance.
I'm conscious that your coffee's getting cold down there, if you want to grab it.
Yeah. I'd go on, you cut out what you have.
That's fine. No, this is absolutely great.
Well, this is what, you know.
But you've talked a lot about the threshing and the gathering. Mm. Were you involved at all in... Where was that taken to be milled in those times?
Well, that would be sent off to seed merchant. Breweries bought a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can go down that road. I don't know how much you want, but you used to have what we call the corn hall. And people used to take their samples to the various corn buyers, and like, I mean, Fakenham corn, a small town like Fakenham had corn. But we used to go to Norwich corn hall, and Dad would take the samples for some of the farmers, and he'd go around the different corn buyers and get the best price. An uncle of mine was head brewer at Young's Crossing, Young's in Norwich, and he'd look at Dad's barley, and if it's up to mark, he'd buy it. And they used to come round, and they had this looked like a big watch, really. You took the cover off, and there was no end of holes, and they used to put the barley, and the barley would fall into these holes, and a big knife would come across and slice it. And they'd look at the barley to see what quality it was. But of course, now it's all analysed chemically about moisture content and all that sort of thing. I mean, well, everything is more or less high tech. That's marvellous, but things are de-skilled, really. The human input is reduced in many, many areas. I mean, I worked in a lot of these systems. I worked on all electromechanical in the early days, but now you've got these boards. Obviously, somebody knows. I think you probably know how they work, Alistair, but most of us ain't got a clue. That's on that board. Okay, stuff another board in. But so in some ways, it's easier, you know. And, but get back to the farm. Sorry, go on.
No, please.
Yeah. And the war, as I say, what was exciting, and we had like a jungle telegraph. These aircraft, heavy land, and they'd be pranged, as the RAF used to say, crash landed. And the kids had come round. We'd get on a bike, says, "Oh, there's one crashed up like Wadesbeck Road or across the Little Snoring Road." In fact, there were three aircraft all piled up on top of each other on the Little Snoring Road, basically because they'd found out like the runways were too short. And my goodness, you can imagine. They closed the road and we had to go further way round. Was a place through a place called Thorpland. My goodness, that was a letdown. But us kids, we get in these go to these crashed aircraft, and you can imagine, you know. I remember one that ran off the end of the runway and kept running, and that it was a soft meadow, and that kept going, and the wheels got in deeper and deeper, and then the wheels stopped, but the tail kept going, and this thing was, the tail was up in the air. Well, for us kids, we'd get in this thing, and we'd get up where the tail gunner was, and you could slide down to what we called, the main, or the rear spar. I mean, I've flown in the dozy thing, so I should know. But we'd slide in. But what we'd collect was bullets. You know, we used to take bullets and bits and pieces. But the real good thing that we used to get out of these kites was the glass. I learned what the name was when I worked on aircraft. The posh name is polymethyl methacrylate, but if you could spell it, you're a better man than I am. And we'd take this glass and we'd make rings and also crucifixes and armlets and all sorts. But we were not that high tech. I remember how we got a hole in this was we'd heat the poker up in the fire and burn a hole through. And mother say, what are you boys up to now? Because the smell was something horrendous. But anyway, we got a lot of fun out of this. And I was that much more fortunate because up in Dad's workshop, we had sort of the machinery area, we had the blacksmith area, we had the chippy area. So I was into most things as a kid. And as I say, I had this mark. And I had my first gun, I think it was about 9. The war was still on, my first shotgun. It was what we call a number 3. If any, it had this bit smaller than a 410, and the cartridges were white and green checks. And I know that was what we call a long barrel number 3. Mm-hmm. There was a small bolt action one, but mine was a long barrel that killed a bit further. And money, Grandad used to buy the cartridges, but they used to pay me for the rabbits and the odd partridge and pheasant, so I couldn't lose. Another thing was rats. I used to stand, hide up and wait for the rats to come out. What a wonderful childhood. So different today, you know. Yeah. I was so fortunate, you know, when I see people behave the way they do, and I look at myself, I think, well, if I'd have been born in a high-rise flat in Tottenham and didn't know who my father was, I wouldn't be the person I am. But that's how it is.
But perhaps we could move. How did you come to be in Burwell?
Well, I'll pop on. I'll holly that one through now. But actually, the end came when the war finished. I was sent off to a Termley Border at school, which was horrendous. Finished school, and then when I did my national service, I was posted out the Middle East. I learned to be an airframe mechanic, and that's a bit of luck, really, because you couldn't get working on aircraft. They told me that if you didn't sign on as a regular, which I didn't particularly want to do. Anyway, I was called up and had to go and see the careers officer, and we got chatting, and he sort of said, you're a bit of a nuisance, sort of had a real go at me. But all of a sudden he said, what does your father do? And I sort of explained it, and he said, do they keep pigs? I said, oh, yes, sir, they keep pigs. He said, are they Gloucestershire spotted? Well, I'd never heard of the dozzy things. I said, oh, no, they're large white, large black. And as it happens, we got into an argument about pigs, and after a bit, I realised he was sir, and I was just a bottom of the heap. And he said, what was it you wanted, old chap? I said, well, I'd like to be in airframe engines. Or you leave it to me. He said, I'll see what I can do. And that's how life... Anyway, I came out of the mob, and Dad had sold up, actually, because Grandad had died, and Dad sold up. He was medically. And what there was, my brother took over. Well, I came to work for Marshall of Cambridge, and I used to go home weekends. I was a real motorbike maniac by this time. I even had a Vincent, so if people in the motorbikes don't know what a Vincent is, but I wish I had it now, it'd be worth a few quid. Anyway, I worked for Marshall, and thoroughly enjoyed it. The first hangar I worked in is what we call number 4 hangar. We were working on T-11 Vampires, which are trainers, and Venom 4s. We built Venom 4s there, but that was the side of the road where the car people are now. Anyway, I met my wife, Chris, on the fair, and... we sort of got together, and we got married in 57. We had 3 children, which really do us credit. I'm so fortunate to have the kids I've got. When we first married, we lived in a caravan in Water Beach. But I always wanted a house, bungalow, whatever, with plenty of room. And by doing a job for this chap, he was a Cockney man, and he seemed a bit, I don't know, he'd been invalided out of the war because he was in the 8th Army, and he was a real businessman, and he'd taken over a bomb site in London. That's how he made his money, squatters' rights. And he had this boat, and he asked me what to do about it, because engine controls were down the back, and to alter the engine, he had to go from the front to the back. I said, well, that's easy enough. I said, we rig up some Bowden cables. Anyway, I rigged this up by using Bowden cables so he could drive the thing and control it from the front. And he was so pleased, but he was amazed. He said, what do I owe you? I said, ah, that's all right. And he was absolutely amazed. I think he was the bloke who'd, you know. He said, anything I can do with you, for you? I said, yeah, find me a good property. I said, with plenty of land, cheap. Anyway, we went. He said, leave it with me. And I thought, that's the last I'll hear of it. And this is how I come and live in Bowell. He found this bungalow, which was not in particularly good nick, but I looked at it and that was all, you know, there's nothing there I couldn't fix, you know. And the princely sum was 1,615 quid, which was not that Marshall gave money away, but if you like to work hard and save, it was quite easy to furnish the mortgage and the wife could be at home and look after the kids. Sadly, that's not so today, but... And this is how I come to be in Bowell. And Mr. Goodchild, who was one of the builders, he built the bathroom on for me and did some modifications in the kitchen. When I came here, I was of that age when I joined the football club. So obviously you get to know people of your age. And I look back now at some of the older people who, you know, sadly passed away, like the likes of Reg Bridgman, Roger Fuller. They sort of founded Burwell Swifts and they're still running. Another one, Alec Bowman. Alec was still playing. I think Alec's still around, actually. And although he was a generation on from us, he was still a very live wire. I think he had a trial for Ipswich as a youngster. Anyway, the tennis club. I joined the tennis club a bit later on, and we used to play down the Wreck in those days. Lovely down there. And of course, through the tennis club, I got to know many of the people. I started playing actually in 1943, and I only packed up about 5 years ago. I had to go in and have a bit of an op, and I've, you know, never got over it well enough to play tennis. Although, I mean, I played rubbish tennis, but it didn't matter. We really... And the friends that you made, I mean, I've got friends like one dear... I won't name, start naming people, do. I wouldn't know where to stop. But one dear friend of mine, I think, must have been going there over 30 years. Every Saturday, there's a free cup of coffee and a donut. So you'll know who I'm talking about. And his son, he's a very clever man, and as I say, I spend a lot of my time in my workshop. I make models and clocks, and I'm getting now, I never was that bright, but I'm not as sharp as I used to be, and I'm now looking through a set of drawings for a railway engine. I've never made a railway engine, and...
Perhaps before we go on down, what was the Burwell sort of centre, the shops and things like at that time?
And because Burwell was so full of shops. When I say full, I'm pretty sure we had three butchers. And I remember Roger Fuller had one down the other side, further down in the co-op, nearly opposite the Baptist Chapel.
What year was this? Roughly what year was it?
62. Yeah, it'd be about 62. It was 62 when I came here. Yeah, 1962. I've been here just over 50 years, you know. And don't seem a day too much. There were three butchers in the village. Reeves Fish and Chip Shop. And there must have been four or five pubs. And grocers, of course, there was the co-op. There was Mr. King, opposite the church, right opposite the church. That's who we used to get our groceries from, Mr. King. And then there was another one, down where the knoll is, where Enyon's Corner. There was another shop, I forget the name of it, that was there, my head's like a sieve, you know. Then you had Doors. I'm sure there were several more, but sadly, memories, you know, they're not as good as they were.
Can you remember the first time you saw the mill, the windmill?
Yeah, the mill was obviously just a thing of interest, and actually I used to talk to the man who used to run the mill. Neil, Mr. Neil. And a thing I discovered, which you wouldn't realise, one of the most interesting things I did discover about a mill was you only worked when the wind was blowing. My goodness, so it's funny, you don't think of these things, you know, on still days. I don't know whether they got paid on still days, or they probably get up at midnight if the wind got up at night. And that's the sort of thing we didn't... I have had a bit of input into the museum, actually, because I made a sundial for Paul Hawes in memory of his wife. And we also made a set of stocks. We went over near Royston. We took some photographs and I took some measurements. But, of course, with the Dutch elm disease, that was a bit difficult to get elm. Well, it's quite expensive, actually, now, which actually would be demand and supply and demand. I used to do a bit of farm work to earn a bit of extra money. I know people be the Driver family who farmed here for several generations, I'm pretty sure. And in those days, the sugar beet, the weeds in the sugar beet all came up, and we used to have to hoe the sugar beet. So you leave one every so far, and they used to say you've got to leave a cock plant, i.e. the good plant. And then used to have, we call single them, because you get two together. And that was quite... I won't say hard work, but meticulous, really. And I think you hold an acre, I don't know, I think about £5 if you did an acre. And they're rolled, as it rolls on sugar beet, from my memory, it's like 22 inches apart. So you realise that there was quite a... there's a lot of... It's hard way to get a fiver, but anyway, a fiver was a fiver. And that'd probably pay your mortgage and whatever. But
you mentioned that you knew Mr. Neil,
yeah,
who operated the mill. But were you ever in the mill when it was operating?
No. I think it had packed up. It was like that. I don't know. I don't know.
Were you ever in the 60s? Were you actually? Did you ever go into the mill itself?
No, I didn't. No. See, because the mill. The museum didn't exist.
Yeah, I appreciate
that. Was through Paul
that,
Hawes. He's the ramrod, you know, old Paul and I, we said, it's funny, we were out in Egypt the same time. I was out in Egypt the same time as he was, but he didn't. We didn't know that, or we would yak, and you know you do. Mm-hmm. But and the Driver family, an old Bill family, and there was Mr. Wally Driver and Dennis, who sadly is no longer with us, and of course Brian still is, and Dennis's son is running the farm now, and Brian is just retired. But it used to be good fun. I remember one very warm spring when I used to go cutting out, as we called the sugar beet, and we were down Swaffham Fen, and it was that hot. Dennis and I went for a swim in the hinterline drain, so as I say, dear old Dennis is no longer with us, but I've got many happy memories of that. And I think the last time the drivers ever cut corn with a binder, I helped Mr. Driver. He drove the tractor and I was on the binder. Another thing I'll go back to, a memory's jog, is Dad used to go around stacking these stacks. Some of the people built very poor stacks and they used to lean over. And they used to prop them up with wood. Now, I'm probably, this term's probably lost in the mist of time, but the piece of wood that propped up the stack, we called a lawyer. Anyway, I continued at Marshall's. I worked for Marshall for just on 10 years. And I used to travel in with, sadly, another man who's no longer with us. People remember Wally Hardy. Quite a war record. He was with Wingate's Chindits. He went through the Far East, but dear old Wally, he's gone. But we used to travel to work together. And
yeah, you mentioned doing the sundial.
Yeah.
Were there other things that you did in relation to the museum?
I have taken stuff, model engines and bits and pieces and clocks, mm-hmm. on whether an open day. You know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do, one or two people got old tractors and I'll turn bits up for them now and again, you know. Mm-hmm. Sort of handyman, if you like, you know.
Have you been round the old vehicles that they
what?
Have you looked closely at the old vehicles that they have at the museum?
Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I turned a... Yeah, the big old Yankee car, they lost a bit. Anyway, I had to turn a little bit up, because you can't bother stuff now, and that's pointless going to a firm. I want an arm and a leg there on these CNC bits and pieces, so the programme take longer. Yeah, I made a bit for that. But they got an old drill of mine up there. It's an old flat pulley drill. I passed that over to them. But what amazes me, I mean, goodness me, I only got 1 foot in the well, I got a couple of weeks ago anyway, but when I look at this stuff, that was modern. You'd remember this stuff coming out, but now it's...
Can you remember any of the particular vehicles when they were maybe driving around Burwell?
Well, the Burwell buses. Oh, yeah, Mansfield. Yeah, but you see there again, Burwell then. I mean, it's quite... How progressive... I don't know whether it is progressing. The cost of transport now is exorbitant, but when I first came here, Marshall's had a bus. The people who work for Marshalls, they could pick a bus up. Poys had a bus. Brignall's and the builders had buses. Well, the men would, it was cheaper to go on the bus than it was on a vehicle, if you had a vehicle. Mm-hmm. Which, and I know dear Eric Jacobs, I'll have to mention Eric, he's an institution, the Jacobs. He's a Burwell, well, his dad was a Burwell man. And Eric obviously was a Burwell man. And he was telling me, he was, before the war, he used to cycle into Cambridge to, he was a carpenter joiner and a very good one. And he used to cycle into Cambridge, I forget which builder it was, to do his apprenticeship. And he also, people that even came from Islam cycle to Cambridge to do their apprenticeship. The builders we had in Burwell, Mr. Palmer, who was also an undertaker, Mr. Goodchild, Fuller and Blackwell. There was still work to be done on farms. So people were employed locally. you didn't have all this terrible expense of getting backwards and forwards to other places and providing your own transport, and you couldn't claim the tax or the VAT, which got me nose a bit, but there you go. And people used bikes. When we went, I think it was when I started at Marshall's, it was a 45-hour week. I'm pretty sure. Well, we worked from 8 in the morning till 6 at night and Saturday mornings. And played football Saturday afternoons, Burl Swifts. and that was great. But then the working week came down gradually. And I think the working week, I remember when I was probably late 30s, the working week had reduced probably down to, 40 hours or something like that. And I remember thinking, my goodness, by the time I'm 50, we'll only be working 25 hours a week. Because with all these modern means of production, because idiot here didn't realise that, you have people who haven't got work and the others that have. But then I can get into politics, which doesn't help anybody.
Just a question I wanted to ask is, one of the vehicles that's in the museum is a mobile shop.
Yeah, Henry Horrell.
I wondered if you'd ever shopped at that vehicle while it was...
No, because we used to go... Henry Horrell had got the mobile shop, which is now in the museum. In Burwell, we used to go to the shop. Didn't you come up here? Because we used to go down there, then Lanes, the bakers used to call. We had all the various tradesmen that used to come. But Henry's vehicle, that used to go... I'm pretty sure as far as Islam. And then they used to go. I mean, this new business of Tesco's and that shopping. Well, as I said, we lived in a very small village in North Norfolk. And I counted up before the war, this was, there used to be 12 different tradespeople called. There was two bakers, was. One from Walsingham. We didn't have a baker in the village. One from Walsingham and one from Little Snoring. They had two bakers call. We had three different grocers would call. We had a sugar, soap and matches that used to come and sell paraffin and soap and matches and all sort of, I don't know, ironmongery and all that sort of stuff. And then we used to have a little man, we called him Cockle and Winkles. He used to cycle from Wells next sea, which is about 7 miles from me, where we used to swim. And he would come with his bike and a little trailer, and he would bring Winkles, Mussels, Cockles, and in the season, Sanfa. And you had and a Mr. Roysborough. He was greengrocery, and he used to come around with a pony and trap. And we used to have a fish merchant. I'm desperately trying to think of his name, not that mean anything to anybody, but of course all the herring used to come into Yarmouth at this time, and this is during the war, and obviously before the war, and you'd get the herring fishermen used to come, you'd get herring, you'd get bloaters, which is smoked herring, and you'd get kippers. And that was all regular, you know. And another thing, how the railways were used. We had railways, the next village at Walsingham. And I remember ordering some white mice. The war was still on. So, everything did close down. And there's up in Northumberland somewhere in a comic, because we all had comics in those days, advertising white mice. And I remember sending my postal order off to buy the white mice. And it was delivered to Walsingham Station. And I remember, because going down about 2 days after I sent my postal order, I was expecting the mice to arrive. But I used to go to school in Walsingham, because during the war, they were so short of teaching that my mother she went back as a teacher in the village. And of course, my brother and I went down to a little private school at Walsingham. And I can go on about that. That was an interesting place. Or tell me, shut up.
What sort of age are we talking about?
I went to Walsingham when I'd be what, six.
Right, well, the buying the white mice. That
oh, white mice! I'd probably be about 1944, possibly. Mm-hmm. You see, people don't realise what you know, and you know, but of course you had a wonderful. Well, you did have a wonderful rail network, you know. But school at Walsingham was interesting. Because it was, you had more or less every denomination under the sun. In fact, now I think they've got Russian Orthodox there. That is where the old railway station used to be. But these mice, I go down there. Tiny Allenden, Tiny used to be one of the railway men. Have the mice arrived yet, Tiny? No, they're not here yet. Oh, I must tell you once, because the keeper was the man you got to look out for, because us kids used to run wild, and he was always on his mettle about stopping us kids afraid we'd do a bit of poaching. And Eric, you don't know who Eric was, but he used to give us time, us people, a rough time. And one of the chaps in the village, Teddy Woods, he was a rear gunner. I don't know whether that was in a Lank or a Stirling, I don't know, I can't remember which, but they used to do air tests, and the pilot, if a bloke lived more or less locally, he'd sort of fly him over. And they were, Teddy was stationed up in Lincolnshire, and he wanted to know where Teddy lived, so he said, so they went all the area, and Teddy was up front and having a good shifty round, and he said, good Lord, he said, there's old Eric, I will give his name, in case he said, God, he gave us kids a while of a time. And he was on a field we called 40 acres, quite big, and the stubble was there and the corner being cleared. He said, right, we'll give him a bit of a scare. And they took this kite down, and the wheels actually did touch. He put his wheels down, and that did. We went and looked, and you could see where the wheels had touched the stubble. And I don't know how true it was, but the rumour went that Eric laid flat, but I don't know. But that actually happened. The war is a funny thing. I think the opening line to Tale of Two Cities, the best of times, it was the worst of times, and that's how it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure the world, it was kinder in the 50s and 60s than it is now.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of goodness goes on, and this, that, and the other, but I don't know, we're all independents, it seemed to be. I mustn't go down that road. But then there again, when I was a boy, all my family lived around me. Aunts, uncles, grandparents. But as the work declined in the villages, we all spread out. In fact, I don't know who can afford to live in the village that I come from, because it's absolutely ridiculous. All the housing stock's been sold off, and you know.
Perhaps we can talk a little bit. We're sitting in your bungalow,
yeah,
in Burwell.
Yeah.
There's something slightly unusual about what you have in your garden. You have something that's not very many people have. Which is could you tell me the story behind that?
Most of my time, a large portion of my time, I spend in my workshop making clocks and models. But then an idea came up, another pal of mine. We thought, well, we joined the Cambridge Astronomical Society. And now that's a good deal for anybody. It costs you £5 a year. You have a meeting every month. You get a free cup of coffee, a chocolate biscuit, all for fiver. So I will advertise that, and the unfortunate living came as well. We're sort of looking at these telescopes. I mean, you have the most powerful people in this area in the astronomical side. I mean, somebody you might see or hear about on television or even from America, and they give us talks. To be honest, I can't take a lot of it in. And as for the mathematics, well, you know, my mate's pretty bright and he explained a lot of it to me on the way home. Anyway, I've always been interested in making things, and sort of looked into it, and the idea was to grind a mirror. Now, a mirror is accurate to many decimal places. It really, really is. And so we read, buffed up on this, read a load of books, and I won't detail how to make a mirror, but believe me, that's quite an interesting project. When you look at the figures on the accuracy of these things, you think, well, how can a bald old man in a shed get down to this sort of accuracy? Well, there's not a computer involved, believe it or not. It's by shining light off the mirror. Basically, what it is a concave mirror. I can get boring here, so I won't get too deep into it. And I can't explain, but we won't get into that. I want a focal length of 56 inches, and to enable me to do that, you double the 56, 112, so you want basically a radius of 112 inches. You start off with a flat piece of mirror, and then you have another flat piece of mirror that you call the tool, and you pass this tool in the various ways using coarse grinding paste and getting finer and finer and finer to dish the mirror. And it gets on to finer and finer work. Now, to check up that you're getting there, you shine a light from... Well, in this case, be 56 inches, and you get a pattern that comes up. And by looking at these books, they'll tell you how you've got to manipulate the tool over the mirror to bring this to what you want. Anyway, we made this working great telescope, and a pal gave me because I got several friends. I've got some very good friends. We sort of. No money ever changed hands. I want a world without money, but I've got like useful friends, and we all sort of, you know, we deal away with a middleman. And we got this mirror, got this telescope, and it was, well, quite large, really. And I thought, well, I used to hump this out and put this tripod, but the tripod wasn't stable enough. Anyway, I looked through some magazines, and I could have bought a wonderful observatory. Oh, they're about £2,000. I thought, that's nice, you know. But of course, impecunious as I am, I thought, well, blow me. So I looked into it anyway. And what I did, if you realise, if you get pentagons and hexagons and you join them all together, you can actually make a football. Some of the footballs are made up of pentagons and hexagons. So anyway, I made a mould of a pentagon and a mould of a hexagon, and I cast them in fibreglass, and that's how I made the dome. And the bottom half, I'm a bit of a cheat, Jack, I used pallet wood. I did have to buy some plywood, but that was made some rings up from the plywood and pallet wood for the sides, and then I covered the sides with roofing felt, put wire netting on. There's all boxy, my dear friend Eric across the way, I think, he got the stuff from him, and then skimmed it with cement. So I don't know what the total cost was. I think the fiberglass stuff I got cheaper, so it came from Cornwall. I suppose it cost about 80 quid. A couple of a bag of cement and bits and pieces. So I reckon I made it for 150 quid, as opposed to 2,000.
So this is the Burwell Observatory.
Absolutely, the Burwell. And if anybody wants to look at it, when they come down Heath Road, if they're coming from Hinderpool and you cast your eyes to the left, you'll see the dome. You can see it from the road over there. Or when people take the dogs for a walk, you can see it there. Another great interest of mine are my dogs. And we go out, and that's how my life's made up.
Well, we're sitting here and we're surrounded by lovely clocks, some of which have Barry Bushell.
Yeah.
On the faces.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, funny enough, my grandfather, my people were inventors. In fact, the thrashing drum that they made, the double dresser, and then the combine came from that. But my grandfather always told me that in the 1600s, he didn't say that, he said the old people made clocks. Well, I got research, I've got no end of books on clocks, because I make clocks, you know. And there was the people with my name, the same spelling and everything, and they were making clocks in 1614, I think, and the family continued to make them to, I don't know, 16, whatever. And so that does interest me, just a few hundred years later, that there's me sort of making this old, only I'm a bit Flash Harry. I don't have to use a treadle lathe. I've got an electric motor. And I've gone a bit posh just lately. My milling machine, I've got DRO, they call it. It's digital readout. So instead of moving dials and counting the numbers, doing my arithmetic was not as sharp as it was. Saved me making a lot of mistakes or writing numbers down on the paper. I just watch these numbers flash up. So as my ability declines, so I take over the more modern technology, so I'm sort of haven't declined, you know, as much as I would have done with the Alistair here with his electronic people. I mean, I sort of look at it and I think, well, how does that work? But you know, it doesn't.
So are you the only clockmaker in Burwell?
No, there's another pal in the village, a good, very good friend of mine, Chris. There's Chris and Martin, I won't say the name, but every Friday, every Monday night, they come down and we have cheese and biscuits and a cup of coffee. And they're both into this thing. In fact, I use them now because old Thicko here, as I say, I'm making this, going to make this railway engine. I'm getting all the bits and pieces together, the copper for the boiler and one thing and another. But to interpret these drawings, I find difficult because these, they're not as young as they were, but they are, I've got them to call on, you know.
Were they clockmakers by trade?
No, Chris, he's a lighting expert, actually. When I say lighting, not fitness, but he'll design lighting for, if we go to Heathrow, he's designed all over the world, actually. Australia also. It's quite a science. Yeah, he's a good mathematician, but I think he's written programs now. You know, he does work, I don't know. He's doing a curved tunnel in Australia. Well, you know, it's quite a science. You know? I mean, I don't know much about lighting, but I remember a kid at physics when I was at school. I used to try and shoot pike in a big drain, and that explained refraction of light, so I did learn something at school. I don't know what area do you want me to go off into.
No, I was just capturing, so we've kind of established that you're the Burwell astronomer. You have the Burwood Observatory, and you're the, as far as you know, you're the Burwell clockmaker.
No, Chris, he does. Chris, he's better than I am. He's gonna. But you see how these Wally's doing. I mean, there's old Wally here. Chris, they buy these milling machines, and I mean, he did it all by hand. But now Martin's the same, and they'll get these miller machines. We put what we call a ball thread, which is no back play, they're absolutely accurate. Put stepper motors on them, and they'll type stuff on his keyboard. An idiot here sitting just watching this. But I mean, they're.
So, but you said your grandfather was involved in, or his great grandfather was involved in watch clockmaking.
No, he'd be 16, 15. Ancestors were.
That was their actual trade, or they
were clockmakers. Yeah. See, this I don't know what this means.
If we move around, we can't record. So, but by all means, just talk about it.
Here's a photograph of my great-great-grandfather who died in 1870-something.
Yeah, we're just looking at a photograph of some gentlemen on what looks like a steam engine.
Traction engine, yeah.
Okay.
He was born in the 1790s, actually. And he's on one of the most earliest traction engines that I'm aware of. He, together with his sons, which my great-grandfather was one of them, invented various bits and pieces. In fact, I've got the actual patent at home, patent 916, that was taken out in April 1860. In the small village, they also manufactured different bits and pieces. Horseworks were one of the things that they did, whereby a horse would walk round and round and drive a shaft that could drive machinery. And my grandfather's little boy, he remember going with his father, William Bushell, my great-grandfather, to draw up a place where they wanted horseworks fitted, and they would do the shafting and do the gears and everything. And the thing that fascinated me was, how big is a horse going to be? Because you work the gearing out to suit the horse. I suppose you could drive one with a donkey. But that this is all within... I mean, my grandfather, I spent so many hours with my grandfather. He may have made a perfect fool of me, actually. But he taught me so much, you know. He really did. Not as you'd learn in school, but I suppose what you learn then, that develops into what I call wisdom as you get older. You know, done that, tried that, it doesn't work. If we do it this way, it will, you know. When you're young, you know, everything's got to be done in a hurry. But that's the old tortoise and hare, really.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, when I came, I bought this bungalow, but we had the three children, and... we'd only got one bedroom. We'd got two girls. And we needed another bedroom because Dan was born. My lovely Dan. he lives and works in Oxford. He travels from Oxford, actually. And he was here at the weekend. And we got the boy. And I was going to extend my bungalow because I've got quite a large garden. But... I consulted the neighbour, and they weren't too happy. And anyway, I thought, well, what do I do now? So I went up, and I did a loft conversion. And the fortunate thing was, by belonging to the football club, the chief engineer at Newmarket, who I used to play football with, Alan, and I said to Alan, I want to do a loft conversion here. Oh, he said, hang on, he said, I'll come and have a look. So he got in the loft and had a look round. He said, leave it with me. He said, my boys will draw that up for you. This is how you get planning for missions. And anyway, he got a few weeks later, he said, here, here's the drawings. And I mean, I've built aeroplanes, so I swear if you can build an aeroplane, you can build a house. And that's true, you can. Yeah. Anyway, dear old Alan, this is through football, you know, the contacts that you have in life. I did a loft conversion. Well, I've always been a bit, and I'll use an Arab term, muskeen, which means tight. And I looked up there, and I got 4x2 ceiling joists, which no way would they span 10 foot. And I looked into the thing, and you need 7x2 to span 10 foot. So I laboriously, knocking my knuckles, I planed all the top edge of these ceiling joists up, planed them up. And I ordered 3x2 planed one edge. And by being in the aircraft business, because the Vampires and Venom were wooden airframes, and I'd learned a lot about how they used to glue this. They use this posh synthetic resin adhesive. That's an acid hardener. So I thought, well, if that's good enough for an aeroplane, that's good enough for my floor. So anyway, I got a load of coat screws, and I put coat screws 3x2 with the aid of the synthetic resin adhesive onto 4x2. And then I used to get the Cambridge Evening News, and I'd get any surplus stuff like plasterboard sheets. Anyway, I built, the only help I had, Brian, he gave me, I knocked the hole through the gable end, and Brian gave me a hand to feed the big purlin through, and Chris, my wife, she gave me a hand with some chipboard to get it up on the roof. I will divert a bit now. I've told you about how I make all these bits and pieces. Well, I had a Mickey Mouse lathe that I made my first traction engine on, and that was hard work. And I always wanted a Myford Super 7, which was, you know, impossible with three children, you know, you couldn't splash out. Anyway, I used to go along to Burwell Baptist Church, and I used to sing in the choir. Not very well, of course. And this evening, advertising the Cambridge Daily News was a very reasonably priced Myford Super 7. Well, I got on the phone, and this poor demented lady said, everybody's been ringing up, they put the wrong number in. So I rung all combinations this number, no luck. But I thought, well, although they probably wouldn't miss me, I thought, well, I'll go to choir practice. Now this is, whether it's the good Lord or luck, I mean, you can make your own judgment. We did a choir practice, and the dear lady in the village who's now gone was our choir mistress, and us canaries, we did a job. And when we'd finished, another pal of mine, he's still in the village, he's John, who I used to play football with, another John, I'll bet I'll get the names. And I said, oh, I don't know, this singing, this choir, and this, that, and the other. And I told him my tragic story of having to leave the phone to come and to choir practice. I missed it now. Anyway, I got home, the phone went. John on the phone, he said, do you still want that lathe? I said, yeah, what do you mean? Well, he said, the man who owns it, Colin, is standing in my kitchen. And because I picked, yeah, I'll have it. No, he said, come and see it. He said, I'm shutting the work. This is how I got the first inkling. Real inkling, although I was on the road and I saw things were changing in the early 80s, how business has seemed to be going a bit dicky. He did form plastic, what do you call it, when you Injection moulding. Anyway, I bought the lathe, a very good price, and the stand, well, the thing that's stand on. And I said, you know, I bought it, and the chucks and a few bits and pieces. And I said, what do you sell it up? He said, when ICI start to give discounts, he said, you know, there's trouble ahead. But that's the story of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great. We've been talking for over an hour now, so I think that's probably enough for today, shall we? So I'm just going to...